What was the fault of Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities of the plain? Our Christian cousins might say it was sexual impropriety. We might rebuff them, but I don't think they're entirely wrong. There is intimations of that in the story just after what we read. The prophet Ezekiel describes the ruin of Sodom and Gomorrah as a result of their arrogance and selfishness, stinginess. And the Talmud expands on that idea in lovely parables and stories. So Sanhedrin says that if a person had rows of bricks, the people of Sodom came and each took one brick. And if they were caught, they'd say, oh, I only took a brick. It's not a big deal. But it made it impossible for the bricklayer to finish his work. It was a de minimis category, a category that fell below the threshold of legal prosecution. I just took one brick. Likewise, if a person spread out garlic or onions to dry, everyone would walk by and take just one. So the person had no herbs and spices to cook with. But then if caught, one could just say, well, it's just a piece of garlic. It's like taking a grape from a grocery store, which I believe is totally legal, right? You can take grapes from a grocery store. That's legal, as far as I understand. It's not legal. But it's that impulse. It's just a few grapes. They were going to fall off the stand anyway. And so they weren't. In other stories, they are described as more vicious, but I think as I described at Jean's unveiling, the great flaw of Sodom was thinking that my actions don't affect anyone else, that we're not in a boat together, and if I just drill a hole in my side of the boat, it doesn't affect you. That's, to our sages, the flaw of Sodom. And the question of which way does righteousness flow, I think, follows out of this. We have people like Abraham and people like Lot and the Sodomites and the angels. Who will corrupt whom, or who will elevate whom, seems to be the essence of the question. And the question was also raised in Parshat Noach, in the story of Noah, about righteousness being an absolute or an objective category or just a subjective category. Do we proclaim our righteousness? Are we at a fixed place or a universal place? Or is it really only in relation to our context, and we have the ability to bring down or bring up those around us? So there is a very bad translation in Eitz Chaim of chapter 19, verse 19. And Lot is eager to escape the razing of the cities of the plains, and he says, I really don't want to do all this work, but can I go hide in this one small place I know of? Can I just go a little ways away? And he says, if I found favor in your eyes, I think he's talking to the angel visitors, let me just save my life by going to this other little place nearby, because tidvakani hara'a vamati. I don't recall what the translation is, but literally what it's saying is, the wickedness of this place is sticking to me, and that will cause me to die. That whole concept is what I want to address today. Does wickedness stick and adhere, and does goodness promote and pass along? Are we stuck at one level of righteousness? Do we have the ability not only to improve ourselves, which I've said many times, but by our image improve or cause decline for other people's moral spirits? And I would say that the parsha unequivocally is going to tell us, yes, you have a role to play. So Rashi, I think echoing Rashi's and Midrash comments on Noach, puts these words in Lot's mouth about that verse. I was only righteous among the wicked, but if I leave here, I'll be wicked. Everyone will recognize that the wickedness of Sodom is sort of inherent now in my spiritual DNA, and I can't fully escape it. I seem like a good person as long as I stay in a bad place, but I've been so corrupted by Sodom, and some people in other Midrashim say it could happen in a day, it's such a bad place, that if I go elsewhere, they'll recognize the taint of the wickedness of Sodom on my spirit, on my flesh, on my ethical character and comportment. Rashi is saying, I think, of this verse, that wickedness can stick to you and befoul you. And we see this sort of relativism with regard to Abram. So these same gentle persons, and again, like the apparition that fights with Jacob at the riverside, they're described as people, but certainly in the rabbinic and midrashic mind, and probably already in the Torah, there's an intimation that they're not just people, if they are people at all. So we very quickly come to see them as both human and angelic. How we read the Torah, how the sages read the Torah through midrash, is still ambivalent, I think. But let's leave that ambivalence up in the air. So these same folks that are called humans when they visit Abraham are called unequivocally angels when they reach the cities of the plain. So there's that transmission of the story. These same folks kind of visit Abram after his circumcision and greet him, and Abram greets them, and it's an annunciation scene to say that Isaac is coming. And then those folks, I always imagine they kind of go down the hill to the cities of the plain and they announce the destruction of the cities. They're captured, they're taken in by Lot. So they're called humans and then angels. And Rabbi Levi in Midrash says that Abraham had high spiritual strength, so they looked like men to him. That he was already on this level, so they were like this, they're close enough, they look just like me. Whereas Lot was a weaker person, and they looked much higher, much more elevated relative to him, so they looked like angels. We don't get a clear sense of whether Lot started out as a decent person, although, actually, I think we do. It didn't occur to me in preparation, but there is a scene where he and Abram decide which way to go, and Lot picks greedily. When he and Abram decide how to divvy up where they'll live, Lot picks with this greed for the cities of the plain, as if he knew, you know, this place isn't good, but it'll be good for me. I like to live in a body place. I like to live in a place with danger, risk, and crime. That sounds more fun to me. I guess he would be the one that helps gentrify the neighborhood, maybe. I don't know. But that's actually the point. He doesn't gentrify the neighborhood. He is not a harbinger of improvement to the neighborhood. And you see that extremely clearly. I was talking to Owen on the Bima. So there's that negotiation, right? If there's 50 people, will you save the city, Abram says. If there's 40 people, what about 35? What about 30, 20, 10? What happens next? What's the resolution of the negotiation? Stops at 10. The negotiation ends. I mean, biblical critics would say, well, as a different source enters, and that we need to hear the story of the angels, but the simple fact is, it stops at 10. We don't know whether the negotiation ends fruitfully or not. It seems to me, from the way Marianne's last reading went, that God kind of lets Abram think, this is going to work out fine. And Abram goes back home feeling relieved, maybe, or content that he had done his job. But obviously, that wasn't enough. So here's the question no one asks. You've got Lot, his two sons, his two daughters, presumably some kids. Aren't there 10 people among them that are decent? It should be a big enough family to find 10 decent people if Lot himself has a decent family. There's no accounting, but you know of at least, I think, 5 people in Lot's family, the himself, two daughters, two sons-in-law. And so that's halfway to 10. Throw in a few kids and a few retainers, you should have a decent household enough to save the city, and that never happens. It's hard, right? It seems that Lot has been corrupted, and this question came most to mind later in the parasha, where we have the stories of, as I was saying to Kim, the continual wordplay around Isaac's name. So in the Annunciation scene that starts the parasha, we have Sarah laughing, which is the same root as Yitzchak, Isaac's name. We have Yitzchak being the child that brings her joy. And then we have Yishmael, his half-brother, who plays with him. And therefore, Sarah says, they have to leave. So a lot of people struggle with that. This is a bit of a parenthetical. A lot of people struggle, oh, Sarah's being cruel and vicious. And the sages say, no, that word to play really either means idolatry, sexual impropriety, or shedding of blood, or violence. They're not wrong. that word to play isn't good. It's not Settlers of Catan. It's not a board game. They're not drawing together. In a lot of worlds, it's a high compliment to say someone's serious. Right? So I think that comes from the same idea. Playing is not a good thing. It's a sense of frivolity that leads to sexual license, violence, ritual license. It's not a good thing. The Chafetz Chaim looks at that scene that we didn't read today, we don't read today, and puts kind of in Sarah's head what she's thinking is, ugh, this Yishmael is not a good guy. There's something corrupt about his character. Somewhat of a sociopath, maybe. I don't want to go too far because the Torah isn't clear on his character. And in a lot of traditions, he's quite wonderful. But the Chofetz Chaim, the 19th century rabbi of, I think, Lithuania, says, she's asking the essential question that I'm asking today is who will prevail in a battle of character? Do we rise to the expectations that are set for us, or do we descend to the lowest common denominator? And she's afraid that Isaac's going to fall to Ishmael's level. Whether we want to accept that Ishmael is of a lower character or not, that's not the point. She believes it. And so she has to exclude him because she needs her son to have better role models. So then the question I want to think about together is this. Which one are you in the story? And what's the best perspective to take in one's life? Are you relatively righteous or relatively wicked? If we want to understand or perhaps believe that there is no objective righteousness, that these things are on a gradient, a scale, a sliding scale, which one are you? And I'm going to suggest that the best outcome, the best perspective to start with, is to assume that you are at least righteous enough and that other people are even better. That seems to be Abraham's viewpoint. He was able to, by some traditions, see the good in people. We get this through Hasidic traditions also, that a great Rebbe is the one who draws out the blessing in others, that sees Ahavat Yisrael, the true joy and love of every Jew and every person. Sees the blessing and the holiness, the holy spark in each person. And so we're told that Abraham did it. And we also know that one of his spiritual descendants, also named Abraham, Abraham Lincoln, could also do it. In his inaugural address, I think the second inaugural address, he talks about seeing the better, lifting up the better angels of people's nature. So in a world where morality might be relative, and in a world where we don't know, behind a veil of ignorance, we don't know which place we find ourselves in, best to assume that you are not wicked, and best to assume that others are even better, and all of you strive towards a high expectation. And I'll leave you with just a nice idea to inspire you on this front. So we have the Akedah, the testing of Abraham. Would Abraham sacrifice Isaac? We're not going to go there because it's spiritually and theologically impossibly complex and problematic, which is really good. Scripture should have those conundrums for us, right? Scripture should present parables and paradoxes to us that force us to do intellectual and spiritual work. But the interesting thing is that he is tested. That's the word that's used. So Midrash says, in the name of Rabbi Jonathan, a potter... I didn't check this with my wife in advance. This may not be true. A potter doesn't examine defective vessels because he can't tap on them without even breaking them. You can't give them a single blow without breaking them. So if you know a bowl is junk, you don't poke at it. Right? It's just going to fall apart anyway. Not worth selling. Karen won't even sell those things. So you test the sound vessels. You look at the ones that came out well and check them. Because those ones will endure. So too, the Holy Blessed One doesn't test the wicked, but the righteous. So although Pirkei Avot says that you should not truly believe in yourself until the day you die, meaning don't take yourself too seriously, don't believe the hype about yourself, at another level, it's worth striving to and imagining oneself not as inherently wicked and fallen, but as inherently capable of inspiring others through your good behavior.